Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Sailing down my dirty stream, still I love it, and I'll keep the dream.
Starting in the 1950s, chemical dyes made at a factory in Toms River were sold around the world, but the factory's hazardous waste stayed put. Residents reported strange odors in their drinking water. Vacationers who swam in the river near the Jersey Shore found purple foam sticking to their skin, and an abnormally high number of children were diagnosed with cancer. Dan Fagan, director of NYU's Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program, chronicles the political battle that followed in Tom's River, a story of science and salvation, which won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction and is now out in paperback. Dan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
Your story begins in Switzerland at a dye manufacturing company called CIBA, C-I-B-A, later renamed Tom's River Chemical. How did they end up at the Jersey Shore?
Yeah. Well, it's a long and kind of fascinating story. Let me just say at the beginning, Brian, happy anniversary.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for doing what you do so well for so long. Appreciate it. Tom's River was a backwater, a place that was a very small town where not that much was going on. And CIBA was looking for a quiet place to transfer its chemical operations because the previous places where it was, initially in Basel and then later in Cincinnati and other places, it was constantly running afoul, literally, with its neighbors, either by tainting well water or groundwater or polluting the river. It was also, you know, a lot of visible air pollution. So Tom's River was a very attractive place to CIBA for a few reasons. There was a water source nearby, and they were making dyes, and dyes require a lot of water. And also you need water to dump your wastewater into. Also, the soil was very sandy, so everything that you dumped would just sort of disappear, or so they thought. And then finally, it was a very isolated location with a dense buffer of trees on all sides. So there was a lot of privacy.
And you characterized Tom's River as a sleepy town where hierarchies were respected and authority trusted, a place where the Swiss could do coal tar chemistry on a grand scale without interference from outsiders, where the river was theirs for the taking, unquote. So what was it about the town's political culture that, man, again, we're going back to like the 1950s here, right?
Yeah, and earlier.
And the town's political culture made it an attractive place for this kind of chemical manufacturing plant.
Yes, I think that's true. But I don't think Tom's River was unique in that way. I think like most small towns, small to mid-sized towns, it had one dominant political party and a political machine that ran things with a very strong family component to that machine. Back then, the family was just starting to lose power. And also, as we often see over and over, it was a town that was really looking for economic development wherever it could find it. And that's why people were so excited when the Swiss came to town. There were brass bands. There was a blimp,
really,
nearby.
It was seen as a big thing and a good thing.
Oh, very much so. People were thrilled to have them there. There were a few discordant notes, but as I explain in the book, but they were really shouted down. It was everyone was thrilled to have them. And let's be honest, the arrival of the plant in the short term created some good things for Tom's River. Those were good jobs, blue-collar jobs that paid well, that you could, you know, buy property in Tom's River. And by the way, your property appreciated in value because the town was growing quickly thanks to the plant and then later the arrival of the Garden State Parkway. So if you didn't think too far ahead, the arrival of the plant was a very good thing for Tom's River.
So how aware, how early was Tom's River Chemical that their plant was endangering the health of people in the community?
Well, that's a really difficult question to answer. And it's never as if there's sort of one eureka moment. It's always sort of a gradual accumulation. But as early as the mid-1950s, they had polluted their own wells at the plant. And people in the factory, you know, were tasting their factory water wells and said, this does not taste good. And the company's response was to drill a new set of wells that were uprange, upgradient, so in other words, their own waste would not pollute it. Their own waste continued to run into the Toms River, which is really basically a creek near where the plant is. And that turned out to be a big problem because there was a set of public wells that supplied the whole town just downstream on the riverbank, and it essentially pulled water from the river through the sandy banks, distributed it all over town. So starting in the early 1960s, people started to see that the public water in town was tasting funny. And of course, the people who worked at the factory and also had houses nearby said, oh yeah, we recognize that taste.
Huh.
That's the same taste that we tasted in the factory's wells. So there were lots of indications, certainly by the early 60s, that there was rampant pollution of groundwater and surface water.
Listeners, anyone in the Toms River area with personal experience with this legacy want to call in for Dan Fagan, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Toms River, A Story of Science and Salvation, now out in paperback, 212-433-WNYC, or anyone else with a question for him, 212-433-9692, a question or a story to tell. Let me flash forward to 1980 when the EPA designated Toms River an abandoned hazardous waste site, more commonly known as a Superfund site, and could legally force companies like Toms River Chemical to clean up the mess. Now, New Jersey has more Superfund sites than any other state in the nation, I believe. I think New York comes in fourth. But all these sites really define New Jersey environmentalism, especially in the 80s. Anybody who was around then knows that this was like definitional to New Jersey's vision of itself and one of the state's obsessions. Was this part of that?
Yes, it very much was. And it's interesting the way you described it. Of course, Toms River itself was not a Superfund site. Large portions of Toms River are absolutely beautiful.
Right, no, I meant
and
Toms,
still
River,
are.
Toms River Chemical.
I know you meant
clear.
Toms River Chemical, yes. but this was exactly the kind of thing that would drive New Jersey folks crazy. You know, that they would say, oh, my God, our town has been stereotyped, our state has been stereotyped as one big hazardous waste site. And so people were really of two minds about it. There was a kind of an element of embarrassment and shame, and people wanted to minimize the problem. On the other hand, if you live near one of these places, you were quite upset about it with good justification, and you wanted to fight hard. And so many of the people who were most involved in the early years of Superfund came out of New Jersey. Bob Torricelli, for example, and as a result, these were very high-profile issues in the 80s. And I really think that, you know, the psychology of this whole thing is that people came to a place like Toms River because they thought they were getting away from that. They thought they were getting away from the problems of North Jersey or Philly, getting away from the industrialization. And they really felt a sense of betrayal as the truth of what had happened in their town unfolded. And that sort of growing sense of betrayal and the growth of an environmental consciousness is one of the things that I wanted to describe in the book, and because I think it's also very relevant to things that are happening today in places like China.
We've been talking a lot about cancer recently here on WNYC. We've been doing a Living Cancer series, and that includes the challenges that scientists face in tracing the environmental causes of cancer. And you write a lot about how hard it was to prove even a correlation between living around this chemical plant and contracting cancer. Forget about trying to prove causation. And yet these parents went to court and won a $35 million settlement, making Toms River one of only two cases to prove that living near chemical plants can cause cancer. So how did the parents in your book convince people that they weren't just the victims of bad luck or bad genes?
Yeah. Well, that was quite an amazing process that unfolded over a very long period of time, and early on, the parents, led by Led DeGillick, but also some other local families, were really ostracized within their community. They were not treated well. People, said mean things and did mean things to them, and And it was a very long process, but they were insistent. They're insistent today that there was a firm relationship between pollution and cancer in their community. And the only reason that the science was eventually done was because they just would not take no for an answer. And then when the science was finally done, and the science itself is so completely fascinating, I think of it as a detective story, but way more interesting than any detective story that you could read that's fictional. Sure enough, it did find a statistically significant relationship, a dose-responsive relationship between certain environmental exposures related to the plant and another set of wells in town that were polluted by a whole nother dumping incident, and childhood leukemia rates in town, specifically of girls. But if you used a sort of slightly more slack definition of statistical significance, you would find those relationships with all sorts of cancers, and not just girls, but boys as well.
And you write in the new afterword to the paperback edition that the Toms River saga proves we need to aggressively investigate cancer clusters, but that it also proves such investigations are a waste of time and money. Huh?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's not quite what I said. What I said, I was making the point that people read into this book what they want to read in, and that I've heard in my many, many conversations with people. People will read this book and say, see, this proves that clusters are a huge problem and we should aggressively investigate them. And I have many other people come up to me and say, hey, see, this proves that investigating clusters are a waste of time. My own view is that investigating clusters is not a waste of time. I feel strongly that we can learn a lot from the uses of epidemiology, which is a long word that stands for something very simple and fascinating. It's the study of patterns of disease. And one of the things I set out to show with this book is that epidemiology has saved millions of lives over the course of its development over the last 300 or 400 years. And I think it's wrong for us to say that just because epidemiology is about probability, it's a probabilistic science, it's not about definite proof, that somehow it's a waste of time or it's not worth pursuing, because we need to get comfortable with uncertainty, and we can apply a good science in a probabilistic way and make important connections.
David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hello. And hello to you, Mr. Fagan. I read your book last year, and I really enjoyed it and found it fascinating. And I'm calling about one thing that I found kind of fascinating and surprising is, you know, when you're talking about the people who began to piece together the puzzle of how industrial pollutants may or may not cause cancer, one of the heroes of the understanding the connection between cancer and smoking is Richard Dahl. And you talk about him as being highly skeptical of connecting pollution to cancer.
He was.
And I was just very surprised by that. And he seems to be kind of a hero on the smoking side, but a villain maybe. That may be too strong a word, but on the industrial pollutant side, and I wonder if you could talk about that a little, please.
Sure. That's a really interesting and astute point that you're making. Richard Dahl is absolutely a terrific epidemiologist. He's passed away now, but he was a tremendous epidemiologist. He had the important insight. He wasn't the only one that the way to reduce uncertainty about these patterns of disease or our analysis of these patterns of disease was to look at really big populations. It becomes much harder to study specific industrial carcinogens. But it's quite possible to study other kinds of risk like smoking, bad diet, so-called lifestyle factors. So that's what Richard Dahl made his career doing. And he did amazing work tying cigarette smoking to lung cancer quite definitively. And he should be praised for that. On the other hand, the kind of epidemiology that he embraced reduced statistical uncertainty, so that's a good thing, but it left little room for studies of industrial chemicals that where smaller populations are generally exposed. And as a result of that, he was quite a skeptic of most other kinds of environmental causation. And later, in his final decades of life, he was a regular expert witness testifying on behalf of the chemical industry and other regulated industries. That doesn't make him a bad man or a bad scientist, but it does mean that he was utterly convinced that we could only speak confidently about lifestyle factors and cancer causation. I know a lot of very smart epidemiologists who strongly disagree with him about that.
Andy in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Hey, good morning. Or is it afternoon, I suppose?
Still morning. Got another 19 minutes.
Okay. Well, God, wonderful. Isn't that great? Okay, so here's all I can say is that as a child growing up on the Hudson River State Hospital in upstate New York near Poughkeepsie, I recall, we went out as kids. The parents would kick us out of the house after we had breakfast on Saturday morning, and they would say, come back for dinner. And we just basically explored the woods and the valleys and the streams. And I recall finding these really bizarre-colored streams running out of the Hudson River State Hospital and going down into the Hudson River. And I filled up all sorts of test tubes that I got from my science class as a child, and I did my science project on that, and someone stole it. Who knows about that? Why? I don't know. But it was all tainted material that was running into the Hudson River. And then,
we're about to run out of time. So, which leads to...
Then we have the Marathon Battery Company in Cold Spring, New York. And I did discover thousands of barrels of cadmium and mercury when I was about 12 years old. And I also went through all of the vacant buildings, and I took all of their ledgers that had been discarded and abandoned in these burnt-out, empty buildings, and I delivered them to the Hudson River Keeper Foundation. And
so stuff this was going on in New York, too.
It was going on everywhere.
And forgive me, Andy, I'm going to have to leave it there. I really appreciate your call, but we're going to run out of time. There was an era, I think, to her point.
Yeah, there was. And everybody's got these stories. Wherever I go, all over the country talking about this book, people tell me stories exactly like that. And I really have two things to say about that, that yes, things are getting better, and we should be happy about that. On the other hand, a lot of the environmental threats that we face today are not as obvious as streams that are colored, and we should be aware of more subtle risks. And secondly, we should be cognizant of the fact that in other parts of the world, China especially, the streams are turning different colors, and the pollution is quite obvious. And China is in a tumult right now over these environmental issues, and we should be supporting those citizen movements in every way that we can over there.
The road to open government in China does seem to lead through environmental outrage.
Absolutely.
Community by community, and that's another show. But we've been talking to Dan Fagan, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Tom's River, A Story of Science and Salvation, the paperback edition, with a new afterword by the author, will be available April 7th from Island Press. There will also be a signing and discussion with Dan on that day. That's next Tuesday at 6 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble in Tribeca, 97 Warren Street. And for any D.C. area listeners, Dan will also be doing a talk and signing at Politics and Prose on April 26th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon if you happen to be listening in D.C. Amazing work of journalism and history. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.